Years ago, I met a man who had an office just outside the Oval Office in the White House. He told about his misguided attempts to protect the President of the United States and his reputation from scandal. His efforts failed. The president he sought to protect was Richard Nixon, who went on to resign in disgrace. For his part, Chuck Colson, a.k.a. Hatchet Man, pled guilty for his involvement in the Watergate scandal. He was the first member of the Nixon administration to serve time in federal prison for his crimes. I had lunch with him once, and time shortly after that introduced him to a very large gathering of people at the church I came from in California. And I was in awe listening to this man. Probably didn't eat much at that lunch because I remember thinking, you eat with little people like me? I mean, this is too crazy. But it was not long into that lunch and our visit that I began to appreciate why he would, in my word, stoop. Years later, after prison, which he quickly will tell you changed his life, he was preparing to speak in a prison in Delaware on an Easter Sunday morning, and he tells of the thoughts that flooded through his mind in that moment. These are his words. As I sat on the platform waiting my turn at the pulpit, my mind began to drift back in time to scholarships and honors earned, cases argued and won, great decisions made from lofty government offices. My life had been the perfect success story, the great American dream fulfilled. But all at once, I realized that it was not my success that God used to enable me to help those in this prison or hundreds of others just like it. My life of success was not what made this morning so glorious. All the achievements meant nothing in God's economy. No, the real legacy of my life was my biggest failure, that I was an ex-con. My greatest humiliation, being sent to prison, was the beginning of God's greatest use of my life. He chose the one experience in which I could not glory for his glory. Today we come in 2 Kings chapter 5. If you haven't found your way there yet, would you please turn to page 255 to the story, another in the series of kind of life journey moments with Elisha, the successor prophet to Elijah. And we come here to a man named Naaman. While you're finding your place here, let me give you just a couple of details of backstory. Back in the days of the United Kingdom under King David, when there was no Israel to the north and Judah to the south, they were united under first Saul, then David, and finally Solomon, before they split in half to the north and to the south. In those days, a neighboring nation in the northeast, Aram, was required to pay tribute to Israel. Aram, by the way, for those of you that sort of in your mind wish you knew where places like that were, is modern-day Syria. So in the day, Aram paid tribute to Israel. About 80 years later, and that would be if you're starting to piece together details of dating and such in the Old Testament, that's the entire reign of David as king and his son Solomon as king. Roughly 40 years each adds up to 80. And at the end of those 80 years, the once united kingdom became divided, split. And Israel to the north, though both eventually met this fate, began a steep moral and spiritual decline. I mean, you talk about losing their minds and losing them quickly. That would describe the spiritual condition of Israel to the north. At that same time, Aram, their neighboring nation, began to gain greater and greater strength and was used often by God to attempt to humble his people and cause his people Israel to turn back to him. Now, Aram's army would make raids into Israel, and those were sort of quick military excursions, and then they would get back out with arms filled with plunder and dragging along prisoners as well. Now in chapter 5, we're introduced to Naaman and a nameless servant girl of Naaman's wife. Look on with me as I sort of begin to unfold this story. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who's in Samaria," which is the capital of Israel, he would cure him of his leprosy. Now, let's just stop for a second, call attention to some important facts. First of all, Naaman. He's a standout general in the army of Ben-Hadad II, who was the king of Aram at this time. So Naaman stands out with highly decorated achievements. If he were wearing a uniform, you would see him from a distance because, in fact, he was colorful with celebrated accomplishments. Yet in spite of his impressive credentials, he was afflicted with an incurable disease, leprosy. Now, I'll spare you the disturbing details, but leprosy was a highly feared infectious skin disease in the ancient world. It left its victims ravaged in disfigurement and ultimately claimed their lives in death. It was the dreaded disease of the day. Probably a category for a broad spectrum of skin diseases, none of which you could go to a dermatologist and find an antibiotic to fix. It was probably a mixture in dread of shingles and AIDS today. If you've met somebody with either of those, you know how dreaded that condition was like. Now, so feared was this affliction that if you came down with leprosy or contracted it, you were often shunned from the community. In the New Testament time, many readers of the New Testament appreciate those words that were cried out by a leper, "Unclean, unclean," as though to warn unsuspecting people, "Stay away." If you think about it, disease-ridden lepers like Naaman, one thing you didn't want to do is stay away from people, the very strong need for family and friends and support. If you want to read a story that's just so compelling, I'll invite you to do so before today's done, so it's fresh in your mind. 2 Chronicles 26, and it's the story of a great king, Uzziah, but he, because of his own sin, was afflicted with leprosy, and you see how his life ended. Now, before I go on, it's worth noting that someone could be at the top of their game like Naaman. They can be successful and admired and renowned, yet something relatively small can take them down. One minute they're flying high, they soar above, it seems, the rest of us, and the next minute their wings are clipped. And they land hard back on the ground. I've observed over the years that physical suffering is the great humbler. More often than not, it takes people and humbles them in its wake. You think you're a big deal, but a thorn comes in unexpectedly like a sneaker wave and hits you and stays with you. And in doing so, it begins to afflict you and flatten you and force you to keep it real. You stop believing the press clips about you. You stop drinking up the praise of people and you go, you know what? I'm just a guy that, quite honestly, you want to know the truth? I define myself by my leprosy. You need another story on this? Read 2 Corinthians 12 and you'll read the Apostle Paul's words, who says that he went up to the third heaven. It was such an awesome experience for him that God allowed a messenger of the devil to afflict him with a thorn. And in doing so, brought him back down to the ground where he cried out, God, please take this from me. And the story goes, no, God never, at least we don't know, it wasn't recorded, removed the thorn from his flesh. So in the shadow of a big man like Naaman, let's go on to a second person in this really important story of the day. A kidnapped servant girl. She's nameless, which says a lot. Stolen in one of the military raids I alluded to earlier. So like your daughter, playing with sidewalk chalk, having a good time. You listen often for the squeals coming from the front yard, just to kind of affirm that everything's okay. And then suddenly the squeals turn into a desperate cry, and you hear the sounds of horse hoofbeats and all sorts of ruckus, and you go out to see your daughter being carried away, never to be seen or heard from again. She lost her name in that moment. She was a daughter of somebody. She had a name, like any daughter. But we're not even told her name here in the story. Could one be described in more modest terms than abducted against your will? Who are you? I'm not sure. I was abducted against my will, taken to a foreign land. Friendless, lonely, virtually forgotten. Her new identity? I'm a maid. I'm a servant. At every level in her 9th century BC world, she was defined as unimportant, without value. It's important to understand the heavy side of this existence, because now you're ready to understand and appreciate God had a very different view of this little girl, young lady. that's God's way, by the way. Ask King David, Israel's greatest king. Samuel is told to go to Jesse, the father of multiple sons, and find Israel's successor king to Saul, who was a fail. And Jesse parades all of his sons in front of the prophet, expecting that one of them would be picked, save David. Why was he not in the bunch, in the lineup? Because he was out tending sheep in the fields. Sometime later, while Israel's army was cowering to the threat of the Philistines, who steps up to take down and take out the Philistine giant Goliath? David, shepherd turned fearless warrior. That's who. So next time you're sure that you're no big deal, remember the Apostle Paul's advice. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. 1 Corinthians 1. 26 to 30. Think of who you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standard. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before him. Now back to the story. who becomes mighty Naaman's hope for healing? His wife's maid. That's who. This girl. Did you make a list as I did when I was reading this? She lost freedom. She lost family. And she lost her familiar home. She lost all of that. But verse 3 tells me something they couldn't take, they couldn't claim from her. She didn't lose her heart. If you lose that much stuff, it's easy to go dark, isn't it? To say, who cares? It doesn't matter anymore. To get sour. Dark is the word I'm using. Am I talking to somebody like that today? It's easy to get that way, but verse 3 says, no, she didn't get dark. In fact, she shines brightly with confidence and hope because God was with her. That's the only way you could shine that bright. To say, you know something, I know God. And I know something God can do for you. Verse 3, there's a healing God has for you. Do you see your situation this morning as a place where God has you to bring hope? It's possible. It might even be a hard place. Until this very moment, you may have thought, you know, if I could just get out of this situation, I can find my way to usefulness for God. And is God saying to you this morning, no, no, no. You may wish you were out. I get that. But like this little girl, God may have you there for just such a time as this. Are you hearing Esther in those words? So persuaded that there was a possibility, Naaman gets permission from the king to go see the prophet in Samaria. Let's look on and pick up the story there. Verse 4, Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, go, the king of Aram replied. I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter I'm sending my servant Naaman so that you may cure him of his leprosy. Look at verse 7. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, am I God? Can I kill and bring to life? Why does this fellow send me someone to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me? Let's stop for a second. Naaman comes to Joram. That's who this unnamed king is. He's Joram of Israel. And he bears gifts in coming to secure cooperation. It was customary in the day. Hey, I'm bringing you a bunch of stuff. Please don't turn me away. Even worse, don't kill me. Okay? Here's some gifts. Please cooperate with me. I need some help here. As you might guess, Joram, the king, was suspicious. I think that's how you have to read verse 7. He thought it was a setup. If I turn away Naaman, his thinking, unhealed, and I possess the power to heal, not true, Aram will use this, the nation of Aram, Ben-Hadad, will use this as a provocation for war, had to be in the mind of Joram. I'm in a pickle. I'm in a tough spot. In effect, the tearing of his robe displays his desperation and his fear of the likely outcome. Elisha, meanwhile, is made aware of this standoff, and instead of doing what would be easy to do, what's that? Stand by indifferently with your arms folded, and with little to no care whatsoever for this man and his condition. Elisha learns of it, and he sends word to Joram, who's in north central Israel in Samaria, and says, send to me Naaman, where the prophet would meet him in a matter of hours, perhaps a day. Down in Gilgal, where he was spending some time, if you remember our last study, in the company of the prophets. This is how it rolled, verse 8. When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. This gets so exciting. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, go wash yourselves 7 times in the Jordan. You could almost see it from where they were. And your flesh will be restored and you will be cleansed. But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to meet me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than this filthy water in Israel? Than all the waters in Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So notice, he turned and went off in a rage. He was ticked. Naaman came full of confidence and pride to the prophet. As a man of hardened military prowess, he was prepared with his plan for how his healing would happen. You see that in those words? I know exactly how this is going to go down. He expected Elisha to meet him and perhaps even in the meeting, salute or whatever you do to a man of great military decoration. Maybe he even thought, you know something? If he's smart, he's going to salute and then bow down and cringe in fear of losing his life if it doesn't go exactly the way this military man wants it to. But that didn't happen at all. In fact, did you see in verse 10? Elisha didn't even go outside to meet him. He sends Gehazi, by the way, that's his servant, his assistant. He sends him out and he tells him the plan. He expected Elisha to somehow, I think of him picturing him waving his hand over, sort of waving a magic wand. All you have to do, wave the wand over the areas afflicted by leprosy and I'll be better. That's what his expectation was. But this prophet is telling me to go dip, wash myself 7 times in the sediment-laden Jordan River? You kidding me? I got better rivers back home. Let me stop for a minute and have you appreciate something. He was proud. The words he stammered off in a rage come from a proud man, used to having many men under his command. He was practiced at giving orders, not receiving them. You know, yet now powerless, this mighty man, to heal himself. And too proud to follow orders. Is this how you read verse 12? He nearly missed out on healing. Isn't that the story of salvation for many? People are proud of their strengths and their skills and their resources and their money and their achievements. We Americans are particularly so. I did this. I'm good at that. Hold your head up. Believe in yourself. And I've done that my whole life, we say. And when we do, we risk out on eternity because, listen to me now, though those things open doors on earth, show somebody your credentials, your degrees, your portfolio, your titles, your resume, your achievements, show somebody that, it'll open a ton of doors on earth, and you know it. That's why you do it. It won't open heaven's door. Not one of those and not all of those combined. Just as Naaman had to wash in the Jordan for his leprosy to be swept away, so too sinners must all repent because we've all sinned and turn to Jesus to have our sins cleansed. Don't miss the wisdom this morning of the words of Naaman's servant, verse 13. Some people want to go meet Peter and Paul in heaven and all the biggies, but I want to meet this guy. Because Naaman's servant comes out big, verse 13. He went to him. Remember, he left him in a rage. So to go to him in a rage meant he could draw a sword and take care of business right now. Right? But his servant went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then this little thing when he tells you, wash and be well?" What he's saying to Naaman, you would have traveled anywhere. You would have paid any price. You would have done whatever was required, made any sacrifice to be cleansed of this dreadful disease, right? Of course you would. I would love to have seen his look on his face at that moment, like, just got to tell you, master, it's the truth. You would have done that. Then why don't you be humble and do the simple thing the prophet says, wash and be well. Apparently, his appeal got through verse 14. So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan, the prescribed seven times. And as the man of God had told him, his flesh was restored and he became clean like that. It became clean like that of a young boy. Someone said this: after dipping, Naaman came out with a cover girl complexion. So good. You know, once there in the New Testament, in the Gospels, there was a man who came to Jesus with life's ultimate question on his lips. He said, "What must I do to be saved?" This story is in Matthew 19 and elsewhere. What must I do to be saved? Let me put it in our parlance today. How can I get to heaven? Tell me the way. If I had you show me your hand right now, how many believe that's the ultimate question? Every hand would go up. It's the truth. How can I get to heaven? Jesus said simply, keep the commandments. The man, rather self-assured, said, "I have." What next? Anything else? Sensing the holdback in his heart, Jesus said, yeah, there is. Go and sell your possessions. Get rid of all of your money and give it to the poor. Question before I tell you how that turned out. Even though we've heard it so often, you know how it turned out. But before you hear me say it, has Jesus offered to freely forgive you of your sins gotten through to you? Or are you stuck on getting in to heaven your way? I meet a lot of people like that. That somehow they can turn the page on the gospel story. So yeah, that's good, that's good. It's got to be something else. I know this worked for people in the past, but there's got to be some other thing. Naaman was stuck on doing it his way for a while. And then he got humble and got well. The man I told you about in Matthew 19, however, never turned the corner, resulting in one of the most tragic verses in all the Bible. Matthew 19, verse 22. When the young man heard what Jesus said, he went away sad, with a tight grip on his stuff. Wow, what a loss. He was saying, in effect, I'll find another door into heaven. That's like Naaman saying, I'll get well on my own. I want to call that what it is, pretty risky. If you're not convinced, you're still here this morning, you're thinking, you know what, that's in the Bible, but I'm going to try it still. I'd call your approach risky. If you're offered the cure, but you won't take it, that's risky. Christian philosopher Peter Kreeft asked this. Suppose someone very close to you lay dying, and the doctor offered to try a new miracle drug that he could not guarantee, but that seemed to have a 50-50 chance of saving your beloved friend's life. Would it be reasonable to try it, even if it cost a little money? How many would say yes? He's not done. And suppose it were free. Wouldn't it be utterly reasonable to try it and unreasonable not to? How many would say yes? Clearly the cure prescribed by the prophet. If you're Naaman, you're looking at that dirty water of the Jordan River thinking, nuh-uh. But it was the prescription, and it was free. And he was healed. Wow. But let me say something to you. As much as he came looking for healing physically from his leprous condition, he got so much more than that. Verse 15 tells us. Then Elisha said, verse 15. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know, is this great stuff? Is this transformed heart or what? Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant. The prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. If you will not, said Naaman, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god, small g, but the Lord. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, he would accompany him to that temple. And I have to bow there as well. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. Go in peace, Elisha said. I think he got so much more than physical healing. I think his another takeaway, Naaman finally was clear about who God is. That's what verse 15 is saying. I, Naaman, live in a world of multiple gods. They're everywhere. It's called polytheism. The belief was rampant in the day that there's gods of the sun and the stars and the moon and the rain and the wind and all the elements. And there's some kind of God in Israel, but he's just one of many. Sounds a little bit like the Baha'i faith today. But he's clear about who God was. The only God is what he says. Yeah, his leprosy was healed, but he's clear about his doctrine. There is only one God. Notice secondly, Naaman took away a heart of gratitude. He wished to pay a staggering sum. I did the math, by the way. It's roughly $3.1 million in today's money, what he was offering to pay for his healing. Elisha refused, though, not wanting to name and to draw a wrong conclusion that somehow Elisha healed him or that Elisha could be bought or was selling favors. I think Elisha simply wanted Naaman to go home and spread the news that there was this incredible God. Remember, he's going back to an idolatrous nation, a polytheistic nation, to go back with a clear message about the one true God. Elisha didn't want to risk softening the impact of that message, not one bit. Howie Hendricks imagines this scene this way. I can just hear Naaman now. You won't believe it. This prophet came down in Samaria, looks me over, sends me down to the Dinky River where I take a swim, and guess what? I come out healed. I mean, absolutely healed. Skin as soft as a baby's bottom. But the real clincher, this guy doesn't charge me a thing, not a measly shekel. Said it was the Lord's doing. Said if I wanted to show my gratitude, I could worship the Lord for the rest of my life. You can bet that that's what I'll be doing. Isn't that great? Naaman, a heart of gratitude, probably got home and could not stop talking. Not just about the prophet, but about what God did in his life through the prophet. And Naaman had this wonderful sensitivity in his conscience. Did you catch that as we read that scene in verse 18 and 19? He knew that upon his return, he would be in uncomfortable situations. Going back to Ben-Hadad, he knew he was going to face even compromising situations. And he just didn't want to go there, but he knew he had to. And he says, can God kind of be okay with this? I'm really only doing it because I have to. I'm not doing it because I have a heart to do it. And I think the prophet's response in verse 19 tells us it's okay. Now, before I have you close your Bible, there's a verse here I want to draw your attention to, verse 17. It's a big deal verse. It's a strange verse. I can tell you in my research, there's about 8 different views on what's going on in verse 17. Here, take $3.1 million. Please, 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 I'm healed. You won't take that? Okay. You okay if I scoop up a bunch of dirt and put it into sacks and load down my beasts and we head home? In a list of fast changes that God brought to Naaman's life, this verse stands, I think, as a snapback to reality. I think, let's give Naaman a label that we use today. He was a baby Christian. Okay? Hours earlier, he knew nothing about this God. He did not go to Israel to meet God. Who did he go to Israel to meet? A prophet, a guy with flesh. But in being in Israel, he meets this God. And he, coming from a polytheistic world, he meets, only had hours of understanding, if that. I think he wanted to scoop up soil as sort of a place to remind him, the dirt from which to remind him, commemorate for him the place where his life changed. If it happened for you at a camp or something like that, you appreciate what I'm saying. But in his case, I think he went a step further. I think he kind of looked at that soil as the place where his life, his leprosy was healed, his life was changed, and it's kind of got this good luck charm feel to it. I was in Israel, and they do this still. At the Jordan River, they sell little vials, plastic vials of water from the Jordan. And they sell out all the time. And I bought one when I was there. Okay? And I was thinking to myself, I even asked a few people, why are we buying this water? It's H2O everywhere you go. It's water. Is it somehow holy water? Does it have intrinsic healing? And some people believe that. Just sprinkle a little of that on you. Special. I took it because it was more like a memento, a souvenir. I'm not sure of that conclusion, but it seems plausible to me given the fact that literally hours earlier, Naaman knew next to nothing about God. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. God, there's a whole bunch of touch points in today's message from you. Even on this verse, that view seems to embrace the reality for most of us who meet Jesus today. When we repent, you in that moment fully forgive us of our sin. And in that moment, a brand new life begins. God, I'm thankful for that. Someone said the conversion of the heart is the miracle of the moment, but the making of a saint is the task of a lifetime. Maybe that's what happened here at the end with Naaman. He started in that moment to walk with you, just like we do. Mostly baby steps at first. But I would love to have visited him later in life and see with my own eyes and hear with my own ears how his immaturities had faded and his lifestyle started to look more and more like the one who saved him. Encourage our hearts today with that truth that you change lives, not just in the moment, but for the lifetime. Help us in our response to you in song and as we give to you to do so with great joy in our hearts because we've met you.